You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Fairhead. Coming up, we'll learn how a flood of cheap guns brought into the U.S. after World War II changed the way we bought and talked about firearms. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about leaving home and finding a new one nearby.
Wisconsin is one of 12 states that requires Native American content to be taught in schools. That prompted Maria Novotny to reach out to WPR's Wisconsin Project, asking us how educators are teaching this in the classroom. As WPR's Gabby Vinnick reports, schools are working to integrate indigenous histories, cultures, and tribal sovereignty into the curriculum.
In a Madison West High School classroom, students take their seats in their first period class. This morning, they're talking about news involving the Cherokee Nation and the push to have First Nation representation in Congress. One by one, students like senior Abby O'Callahan share their questions.
Given the legacy of the federal government and its involvement in the dispossession of Native peoples, how can we move forward at both the local and the state level to kind of make sure that there's a real change in policy?
The class is just one example of how students are connecting the histories of Wisconsin's First Nations to the present day. And it wasn't too long ago that legislation known as Act 31 spurred this education. Since 1991, the law has mandated that public schools and public and private universities teach the histories, cultures, and tribal sovereignty of tribal nations in Wisconsin. It was in response to the violence that erupted in northern Wisconsin in the 1980s. Members of the Ojibwe tribe were spearfishing, and protesters blocked them from exercising a treaty right they reserved. J.P. Leary is of Cherokee descent. He's an associate professor of First Nations Studies at UW-Green Bay. He wrote a book about Act 31.
The real policy problem that Act 31 is addressing is the lack of meaningful opportunities to learn accurate, authentic information about the federally recognized tribes and bands in Wisconsin.
David O'Connor agrees. He's a consultant at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. O'Connor is a member of the Ojibwe tribe and offers educators resources about Wisconsin's First Nations on topics like treaty rights, indigenous languages, and festivities. He encourages educators to weave those lessons into subjects beyond social studies.
If you teach it from a tribal sovereignty lens first, you could teach Native histories and cultures 10 times easier.
Wisconsin is home to 11 federally recognized tribal nations. Teachers like Jeff Ryan of Prescott High School have been working to integrate Native histories more deeply into their lessons. Since 2000, the social studies teacher has taken hundreds of students on a four-day trip to the Lac des Flambeaux Reservation in northern Wisconsin. They talk with tribal elders, do craft work, and tour cultural sites.
To gain a full understanding of the experience, whether it be the history or the contemporary issues connected to Native people, you have to access and talk with Native people.
There are more than 500 tribal nations in the U.S. Ryan and his students discuss what that means.
500 ways of thinking, 500 ways of talking, 500 ways of living, 500 ways of being.
Some critics say Act 31 has no teeth. The law requires the subject matter to be taught at least three times in grades K through 12. But since Wisconsin is a local control state, it's up to school boards and administrators to implement curriculum. Since its passage, more resources have become available for teachers to use. Even so, O'Connor says that for some educators, it's their first time learning the content. Sometimes it contradicts what they were taught.
For far too long, I always think that First Nations peoples and communities have been seen in curriculum as always long ago and far away, rather than being contemporary.
O'Connor says he hopes more schools make teaching Native histories a priority, because, as he says, failing to do so is a lost opportunity for all.
WPR's Gabby Vinnick brought us that story on First Nations education in Wisconsin's classrooms. And the story idea came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. Americans own almost half of all the civilian-held firearms in the world. Our ratio of guns to people is more than twice that of any country, and gun sales set records in recent years. It wasn't always that way. In the years after World War II, cheap surplus weapons flooded the U.S. market and started to be marketed and sold like other mass consumer goods. In his new book, our next guest tells the story of that boom in guns and how our cultural attitudes around them changed. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions about the history of guns and gun culture in the Cold War era and since then, in your lifetime, have you seen a change in the way we talk about guns and the Second Amendment? And how about gun availability, accessibility, and prices? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Andrew McKevitt is the John D. Winters Endowed Professor of History at Louisiana Tech University. He's the author of Consuming Japan, Popular Culture and the Globalizing of 1980s America. His new book is Gun Country, Gun Capitalism, Culture, and Control in Cold War America. Drew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for having me.
You write in Gun Country that a lot of people, when they're talking about guns and history in America, they go back to the founders and the crafting of the Second Amendment and the 1800s. You see much more recent key turning points, starting with the end of World War II. Can you tell a little bit about that history of, you know, Europe in particular, clogged with surplus weapons and how they find their way to the United States?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, the United States has always been a gun country of some sort. But what I argue in the book is that we really become the gun country after the Second World War. And what makes that happen is a number of changes to gun capitalism, to the way guns are marketed, to the way guns are consumed. And the story I focus on is in the aftermath of the Second World War, the incredible availability of cheap firearms from Europe and from Asia. These guns were war surplus weapons. Many of them were rifles used on battlefields in Europe and Asia during the war. And what happens in the beginning of the late 1940s and the early 1950s is we get a whole cohort of what I call gun capitalists who are really entrepreneurs looking to make connections between surging American demand for consumer goods, not just firearms, but all kinds of consumer goods in the post-war United States, which is flourishing as a result of post-war prosperity, and the availability of these cheap firearms. So I write about a number of figures, like the most important of which is a man named Sam Cummings, who creates a company called InterArms, who, beginning in the 1950s, imports hundreds of thousands of war surplus rifles into the United States each year. And these are really cheap guns that drive down the price of guns and increase the availability. And I think we can chart a lot of our gun culture and gun consumerism to that moment.
And you write that guns, I don't think these days we think of them as a consumer product, even though I guess they clearly are. This really was a transformative moment where, you know, someone might have a gun. They might be able to afford one. Now there's cheap guns, starter guns, and they became a consumer item like a washing machine, except you only want one washing machine. How did this change the way we thought?
Yeah, they're consumer goods, right? I mean, they're like the Beanie Babies for men of the 1950s or something like that. It becomes a thing to collect, and it's cheapness that enables that. A brand new, well-made quality hunting rifle in 1955 might have cost you $120, $150 in 1950s dollars, which is something on the scale of, you know, $1,500 today. And that's really expensive for today and for people at the time. And so those were not really sort of entry-level weapons. What gun capitalists like Sam Cummings do is they make incredibly cheap firearms available to more people. So that the equivalent of that $150 rifle is the $10 Carcano rifle that Cummings sells. And this is a rifle made in Italy during the war and imported by the hundreds of thousands in the 1950s and into the 1960s. And this is the very weapon that in 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald will use to shoot John F. Kennedy. And so these cheap guns become collector's items. They prompt a growing kind of consumer market among especially men in the United States, and they're marketed to men as things to collect. That's one of the hallmarks of advertising from this era, is to just display the bounty of guns available and to advertise them as sort of the reward for American sacrifice during the war. You went out and you won the war, and one of your rewards is you get the guns, because this is the only consumer market really in the world where so many guns could be sold.
Another turning point comes in the 1960s, the rise of the civil rights movement, and then riots, especially in 1967 in places like Detroit and Newark, New Jersey. You talk about breathless media reports talking about organized bands of snipers that didn't exist, to be clear. But people start to think about their guns in a different way through this period of unrest. What starts to change?
Yeah, so this is, we have this consumer market there of plenty in the 1950s and the 1960s, and Americans become accustomed to that seemingly limitless access to the world's weapons of war. But beginning really in 1963 with Kennedy's assassination, there is a legislative movement to do something about it. In the U.S. Congress, it's focused on the in the Senate on a figure named Thomas Dodd, who's a senator from Connecticut, who runs the Senate's Juvenile Delinquency Subcommittee, and he's doing investigations throughout the 1960s. What's also happening, of course, in parallel is the splintering of the Black Freedom Movement and increasing tensions in cities and Black uprisings against police brutality, against lack of economic opportunity. And so when you combine this consumer market that has seemed limitless for more than a decade with increasing white anxieties about Black uprisings, and throw into the mix the possibility of gun restrictions coming from US Congress, you get a surge in gun buying. 1967 and 68 is really in some ways it's an echo of 2020 and 2021. With the surge in gun buying we saw as a consequence of the pandemic, of anxieties about another Black freedom movement, this time the Black Lives Matter uprisings of 2020, of a contentious presidential election you have in 1968 and in 2020 as well. And so you see what is essentially panic buying of guns. In 1967 and 68 is an incredible spike in gun buying. And because of all those imports that had been flooding in since the mid-1950s, there's plenty for people to go out and buy.
What does this end up meaning for, you know, if we compared 1938, say pre-World War II, and then coming out of the 60s and 70s, how did we look at our guns differently?
Well, they are seen as items of personal self-defense and a mass level in ways that they weren't so much in the 1930s. There is a wave of gun regulations in the 1930s coming out of the New Deal, mostly targeted at what's seen as the sort of gangland violence of the era. So we get 1934, the National Firearms Act, 1938, the Federal Firearms Act. And guns are, especially things like handguns, are seen at a popular level as kind of tools of criminals. People are seen as sort of suspicious if they need to carry a handgun. But by the 1960s and 1970s, handguns especially are marketed as tools of self-defense. And with the gun control movement of the 1960s, especially the legislative movement coming out of Congress, moving through the Senate, and eventually producing the Gun Control Act of 1968, what that also creates is a grassroots gun rights movement, a movement of people organizing at the local level, not just at the NRA, because the NRA is kind of a little slow to get to this. But we get this grassroots gun rights movement that is organizing around this idea that firearms are for self-defense, and especially things like handguns, because it is, as much as we focus on kind of the big name rifles and so-called assault weapons and so forth, it's always been handguns that have caused more violence in the United States. And so that idea that the individual has a right to own something like a handgun for personal self-defense, independent of service in a militia or defense of the country, that really emerges as a mass popular idea at this moment out of this cauldron of stuff happening in the 1960s.
We're talking to Drew McKevitt, professor of history at Louisiana Tech University. His new book is Gun Country, Gun Capitalism, Culture, and Control in Cold War America. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Drew McKevitt. His new book is called Gun Country, Gun Capitalism, Culture and Control in Cold War America. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I want to put a shout out for the women as part of this culture. I'm a baby boomer, World War II, Madison West graduate. And in the 1950s and 60s, for us, it was a lot of the TV culture. I mean, the bloodless cowboy programs and Gunsmoke. And I was insane about Davy Crockett. I have one Kentucky line, so I think I identified with the frontier. Also, there were no organized sports for girls in our high school in the 1960s, except one, which I think was the Victory Club holdover from World War II. And so we all joined Girls Rifle Club, and I became a sharpshooter.
Interesting, Kay. Thanks a lot for sharing that, Drew. It was a cultural, I don't know, there's a cultural way of thinking about guns, recreational, pop culture. What do you think?
Yeah, no doubt in the 1950s. I think, I forget what the number was, but at some point in the late 1950s, 8 of the top 10 TV shows were Westerns of that sort, right? And so, in fact, one of the things that Thomas Dodd's committee is going to focus on in the early 1960s is they're going to hold hearings on the role of guns in popular entertainment. And I think rightfully so, lots of witnesses come before the committee and they say, this is sort of bunk, this idea that Westerns and so forth make people go out and commit crimes. But certainly it contributed to the popularity of gun ownership, not in a criminal sense, but in more in a sort of mass popular consumer sense. And so it makes perfect sense that we have rifle clubs in the 1960s, and especially rifle clubs for girls too, especially in rural areas outside of cities or in growing suburbs.
Thanks for the call, Kay. Talking to Drew McKevitt. His new book is called Gun Country. Back to your calls. Keith is with us in Kewaunee. Keith, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Whenever we try to get any legislation work going on gun control of some type, it seems like you hear a lot of things about the Second Amendment rights, but it doesn't seem like you ever hear anything about the first three words of the Second Amendment, which are a well-regulated militia. And I guess wondering what the author's take is on Second Amendment and where a well-regulated militia fits into guns.
Keith, thanks for the call. Drew?
Yeah, I think of myself as a Second Amendment absolutist in the sense that I want to adhere to all 27 words of the Second Amendment. And those first three are just as important as the last 13, a well-regulated militia. When historians write about the Second Amendment, they write about the importance of the militia to Madison's formulation of the Second Amendment and to the eventual passage of the Second Amendment in 1791. And so there's no question among historians. There's a very clear consensus among historians that the Second Amendment was about the relationship between the state, that being individual states and a federal government, and how an armed populace factored into that relationship. The amendment had nothing to do with individual gun ownership, which was something that at the time nobody would have really questioned anyway, because there was a general assumption that an individual had a right to own a firearm. There were state constitutions that protected those things, and there was even English common law that had recognized it in a number of ways. But what's happened in the last several decades is that we've had a very aggressive, concerted intellectual and legal effort to define the Second Amendment as a statement of an individual right, and to use those first three words to sort of push those first three words out and pretend as if they had nothing to do with the individual's right to own firearms. And that's not something that historians would agree with.
Keith, thanks a lot for the call. Drew, you point out repeatedly in your book, United States stands out in the world, most of the world, when it comes to gun laws, very few of them, very loosely regulated. And in terms of gun violence, what do you hope, by looking at this history that you tell in gun country, what do you hope we can take from that and learn lessons from to reduce gun violence here in the United States in the future?
Yeah, you know, it was, I try not to be cynical about this history, because there's a moment in 1968 when Bobby Kennedy's killed and Martin Luther King had been killed a couple months earlier, and Lyndon Johnson appoints a commission. Lyndon Johnson loved appointing commissions. He appoints another one. It comes to be known as the Eisenhower Commission. The Eisenhower Commission is going to look into violence across American history and in American society. And they appoint a firearms task force that says that is the first federal initiative to look into American gun ownership, American gun culture, American gun violence. And they come to a number of really startling conclusions. And one of the conclusions they came to at that moment, 55 years ago, was we have too many guns. And they were talking about a country of 90 million guns at that point, and maybe 180 million people or so. They said, we have too many guns, and if we don't do something about it right now with the 90 million guns we have, it's going to be too late 25 years from now, because we'll have 200 million. And then in another 25 years, we'll have 400 million. If we don't do something right now, we are going to miss this opportunity. And we missed that opportunity. And so today, you know, it's hard to look at this history and to think that we are ever going to do anything to reduce the civilian stockpile in the United States. And so I take hope in the, you know, the gun safety movement that emphasizes things like red flag laws and enhanced background checks, because I don't think ultimately we're going to do anything to reduce that stockpile. Instead, we've just got to figure out ways to keep ourselves safe from that stockpile.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Andrew McKevitt. His new book is called Gun Country, Gun Capitalism, Culture, and Control in Cold War America. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Coming up after the news, podcasting is in the midst of a major shakeup this year. An audio industry expert breaks down what's going on in the podcast world and where the industry might be headed next. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. About 10 years ago, podcasts splashed onto the media scene and became the big new thing. Producers were scrambling to make the next big podcast. Entire podcasting companies were created to cash in on the success. Everybody, it seemed like, wanted a piece of the podcasting pie, but the big money and ad deals didn't always live up to expectations. This year saw rounds of layoffs at major companies like Spotify and flagship shows canceled at public radio stations like NPR and WNYC. Our next guest follows the podcast industry. She's here to talk to us about podcasting's first boom and bust cycle, at least in many parts of the industry. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your take on podcasts? Have you been listening for years now? Are you just discovering some? Do you have a favorite? Is that favorite one still being created? Where do you go to listen to podcasts? What platform? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ariel Shapiro is the lead reporter of The Verge's audio industry newsletter, Hot Pod. She's a UW-Madison graduate, by the way. Ariel, thanks a lot for joining us today. Do we have Ariel? Are you there? Looks like I don't have audio on Ariel. Again, you could join in at 800-642-1234 to tell us about your podcast listening habits, if any. Join in at 800-642-1234. Ariel, I think we've got you. Hi.
Hey, Rob. So happy to be here. And sorry for the technical difficulties.
Well, that's live radio. Podcast can just edit that stuff out, but we're stuck with it here. But that's okay. I like it. Ariel, we've seen a lot happen in podcasts this year. Can you give us an overview, especially when we're talking about these produced podcasts, limited run specials, things like that? How big a shakeup has there been?
Yeah. So the kind of podcast that people think of as being these sort of anchor podcasts, right? Like in-depth, narrative limited series, those are really having trouble right now. And part of that is because, and I think you alluded to this in your intro, there was a lot of investment in this space in the past several years, particularly by Spotify. Spotify bought Gimlet, which was one of the biggest independent podcast studios in the industry making these kind of series. And over the past year, they laid off almost the entirety of Gimlet staff. Mm-hmm. And this isn't the only place where we've seen this happening, right? There have been layoffs at NPR, at PRX, at Pushkin Industries, which is the podcast studio that is co-owned by Malcolm Gladwell. And part of the reason is there's sort of this idea, if you build it, they will come, right? Like, there's definitely an appetite for these kind of podcasts. We saw that with Serial when it really exploded mm-hmm. on the scene. The problem is, has that advertising money come in, and is it enough to sustain the kind of production necessary for these shows? So not all podcasts are affected, right? Like, always on chat podcasts, think of the Dax Shepherds, think of the Joe Rogans and the people who emulate Joe Rogan. Those are pretty cheap to make, and they're easy to produce, whereas these more in-depth podcasts require a lot more work, a lot more reporting. It requires people, engineers. And at the end of the day, a lot of these companies saw that the math just wasn't working out, which is really unfortunate if you're a podcast lover, right? Like, you want to see these kind of shows being made. And we don't want to see a world where the podcast landscape is, you know, just celebrity chat shows.
It seems like podcasts are facing the same challenge as a lot of old media, a lot of new media, in that there's unlimited amounts of content out there. A lot of it is free for users. How do we get people to pay, either in subscription, or how do we tap into a pool of finite advertising money? It turns out there's nothing special about podcasts compared to other media sources when it came to revenue.
Yeah, exactly. And you've seen some subscription efforts take off. It's been really successful at a place like Defector, which is really an interesting case. They had Normal Gossip, which, if you haven't listened to it, is an absolutely fantastic podcast and was a really original premise, right? It was this show, very well made and actually very well researched, but just about everyday sort of ridiculous stories. And they've managed to build up not only an advertising business, but also a subscription business. But it's really an outlier. And it took off kind of the traditional way, right? Like, word of mouth, people recommending the show to their friends. And it went viral from there. The problem is that discovery for podcasts is really difficult. And part of that is that it's audio, right? So the way that a lot of things will go viral on social media, it'll be through images and videos. You know, a lot of people now watch these videos with the sound off and the captions on. And some podcasts have managed to take advantage of this, video podcasts like Call Her Daddy with Alex Cooper, which is, you know, currently being produced by Spotify. But not everyone has the money to do that. And, you know, if we're getting into the video space, like, really, what's the difference between a video podcast and a YouTube video? So, you know, it's been really challenging for a lot of these, even very established podcast outlets, to find a way to market their shows and find enough audience to really get that advertising revenue in.
Talking to Ariel Shapiro from The Verge, looking at the rise of podcasts, a big shakeup in the industry this year, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are now or ever have been a regular listener to a podcast or many podcasts, join in with your experiences at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Jason is with us in Rapid River, Michigan. Jason, hi.
Hi. Your screener, she convinced me to stay on the line here. The reason I'm calling, I'm up in Rapid because I'm up at my camp here. It's very cold right now, but what I experienced the last couple of days is I don't want to listen to any of my inventory. And so your screener mentioned that listener burnout might be part of the conversation here. So, you know, I'm a big fan of the Bulwark podcast, the whole spectrum that they have. You might be familiar with Charlie Sykes.
Oh, I've talked to him a time or two.
Oh, that whole Bulwark lineup is great. And, I used to listen to a lot of Joe Rogan and the Meteor, but I don't even know. I have no taste for it, and it's really weird what happened the last couple of days, and I think I'm experiencing the burnout.
Interesting, Jason. Thanks a lot. Is that a concern in podcast industry, Ariel, where, hey, it was this novelty, is this cool new thing for a while, and now, eh?
I mean, yes and no, right? Like, I even find myself, right, like, kind of burning out through my podcasts, or I'll cycle through them. Like, I'll listen to them really regularly for a while, and then kind of fall off, maybe come back to it later. I don't think people are burning out on it as a medium. I think that people tend to find other podcasts that pique their interests and that they can really get interested in. But again, for these individual producers and individual shows, yeah, maintaining an audience can be difficult, especially when there's so much out there. And you know, you also sometimes have these chat podcasts that can be 2 hours long, 3 hours long, you know, at a certain point, you've heard enough. So it's really about kind of, I do think people in the industry are thinking more closely about structure and about ways they can create podcasts that keep people on, not just through force of personality, right? Like, not just because you're listening to someone that you really like, that, you know, maybe think Joe Rogan's funny. Maybe you think Theo Von is another one who's really coming up the ranks that people love. That it's not just that, that there are ways to have podcasts that are always on, but maybe you're getting a little bit more innovative with structure or the way that they produce.
Jason, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Ariel, I want to talk about the bewildering amount of ways that people listen to podcasts, maybe even define them. I've had people say they like my podcast. I don't have a podcast. I have this show, but they're listening to the archive version online later in the day. I guess that's a podcast for them. Spotify might produce a show, the Joe Rogan Show. You can only hear it on Spotify. Somebody else might produce a podcast. You can listen on their website and Apple and YouTube. I can't keep track. Is that creating confusion in the industry? Is that causing some of the problems?
So, I mean, yeah, this is something that we actually talk about all the time at The Verge, and also at some of these podcast industry events that I've been to. What is a podcast? And right now, that's not something that's so simple. Because, yes, a lot of podcasts that people consume were originally radio shows. And that's actually something that you're seeing a lot of these public media outlets do, is focus on shows that can be on the radio first and then become a podcast. Then you have, you know, podcast first, but then you have YouTube shows that are functionally podcasts, but, like, again, what exactly are they? And then muddying the waters even more are audiobooks. So now you see Spotify bringing audiobooks onto the platform, and increasingly they are, you know, traditionally think of an audiobook as maybe it's Pride and Prejudice, right? And it's one narrator who's doing the entire book. Now, because of podcasts, these audiobook producers are being pressured to create audiobooks that sound more like podcasts. You know, maybe they're shorter, they have multiple voices working in there, they have archival sound. And again, where do you really draw that line? Yeah, I mean, I guess if you can listen to it on the internet as a podcast, it's kind of complicated. And everyone's still trying to figure out where to draw that line. And that's particularly it's particularly an issue when it does come to audiobooks, because they're used to charging a lot of money for audiobooks, right? If you have an Audible subscription, that's $15 a month for one audiobook. No one's paying $15 a month for one podcast a month. So again, the market is still figuring itself out.
Ariel Shapiro is with us, lead reporter of Hot Pod, an audio industry newsletter from The Verge. She's with us today to talk about podcasting's boom and bust cycle, including shakeups in the industry this year that could change what kind of podcasts get made, how they are made and distributed, what you end up listening to. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you listen to podcasts? Have these big changes to the industry affected your listening experience? What kind of podcast would you like to see get more funding and support? Do you like ones produced by various public radio outlets, private outlets, you name it? join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with reporter Ariel Shapiro from The Verge about layoffs, show cancellations in the podcast industry, what it could mean for the future of podcasting and your listening experience. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you checked out podcasts over the years? Are the ones you've gotten hooked on? Do you like investigative reporting, long-form interviews, true crime, business advice, former sitcom ensemble players who maybe stoned and talk about conspiracy theories? Whatever you like, let us know about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Lauren is with us in Wauwatosa. Lauren, hi.
Hi, avid podcaster here. So glad to be on. I'm glad you guys are talking about this. I have a comment and a question for thought. I'm that friend who is always like, oh, I was listening to a podcast and heard this, right? And I will say that once the big media companies seem to come in and start kind of formally and professionally producing podcasts, it seems like it took away from the original mystique, was this kind of like independent landscape where people were exploring with production quality and doing investigations independently. And obviously there needs to be revenue, you know, driving some of that. But I think it's driven some fatigue. We hear the same advertisers over and over, so there loses this authenticity. You kind of used to feel connected to your podcast host that they were recommending a product, right? So that was something you tolerated. So that's just something I've personally noticed. And it's driven me more towards audiobooks. So like that long form, high quality investigation, I'm turning more to books, which is an interesting reflection.
Interesting experience, Lauren. Thanks so much for sharing that. Ariel, this, I'm guessing Lauren's not the only one who's thought this, that, hey, they were kind of cool to start, then big business got into it, and they all kind of blanded out a little bit. Is this something you've heard from other people?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, and I want to be a little bit fair to the big business here, in that when Spotify got into it, you know, they were making some really interesting, incredible shows, right? Like How to Save a Planet was the best podcast on the market about climate change. And it was getting at it in really thoughtful and important ways. But when push came to shove and it wasn't making a profit, you know, it was gone. And that's sort of the problem, right? Is that you had all this money come in, bring in really smart people, creative producers who wanted to make great stuff. I mean, it's the same thing you saw in video streaming, right? Where you had all this incredible content that wasn't possible before. Then, right, then reality hits and it's not just about growth and it's about margin. And when you have a for-profit company that where it's really about their bottom line, like that's going to take precedence over everything. And so, yeah, now you're seeing the effect of that, of what are the most profitable shows. And again, this goes back to these celebrity chat shows, and it does become sort of monotonous. They're certainly not the kind of shows that I like to listen to. It doesn't mean that they don't have value. Mm-hmm. I will even defend Joe Rogan in that he is certainly an interesting interviewer, and there's a reason why people listen to him, right? But yeah, it makes perfect sense that Lauren would turn to audiobooks, because on the flip side, you're going to see that kind of in-depth exploration that she's looking for. And also there's been so much innovation in terms of audio production that they've been able to ingest that has come out of the podcast movement. So, you know, it's not all bad, right? Like things, you know, things change and they shift. And I do believe that, you know, the industry will mature and figure itself out and find a way to support these shows, because there are so many people who want to make them. But, you know, it's a difficult time right now. So, and obviously that has an effect on consumers.
Thanks for that call, Lauren. Jenny is with us now in Lake Geneva. Jenny, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say, so for a living, I'm a mobile dog groomer. So most of my day is spent with ear protection on. I listen to so many podcasts every day. Actually, I listen to this show via podcast, but for some random reason today, I ran out of my Monday podcasts and
Yay.
Thought I'd come. And there are also really good Wisconsin podcasts out there. For example, I live in Lake Geneva, and we have, I forget her name, but a woman who does a really great local show and interviews local businesses. And I absolutely have learned so much from that one. I love, like, Charlie Behrens has a podcast. He's in Wisconsin, and lots of comedies and people that have, like, science facts and things, too. I'm just full of information all day from podcasts.
Fantastic. Jenny, thanks so much for sharing that and for listening live today and calling in. Ariel, is this something you see? I know there are more hyper-local or state-level podcasts that aren't trying to reach the whole world. Is this a trend? Is this maybe... is there room for growth in saying, hey, we've got a local audience we want to reach out to?
I think there's definitely room for growth. And I love that she brought that up because it really shows the possibilities, right, that are there with podcasts. In that if you're not looking to make a hit, massive 10 million downloads an episode show, you know, there can be a market for that. And look, I live in New York. We don't have... I'm not saying there are no local podcasts. There are definitely some, but a lot of the media here is geared towards more of a national audience. But like, I listen to the Brian Lehrer Show every single day. You know, if I can listen to it on the radio, I do. And if not, then I listen to it as a podcast later. And there's so much value in local shows that talk to issues that actually matter to people, like, on a day-to-day basis. And one thing that I had been hearing too is about, finding ways to locally target, to basically geo-target ads, right? You come up with ads that are geared towards people based on their location. And that was sort of thought of as a national endeavor, right? It's a way that you can do programmatic ads for a national show, make those ads more relevant to the listener. But there's so much possibility, right, in terms of getting that local advertising and, you know, focusing... being able to get money from businesses in your community that want to be heard by the people in your community, right? Like, I love the idea of local podcasts. There are definitely some. There's not enough yet. But you know, again, in this period of reconsidering what the industry can look like, I really hope there will be more.
Thanks again for that call. And just our last minute and a half or so, Ariel, want to look toward the future. You've written about so-called AI, artificial intelligence, large language models, and the podcast industry figuring out what to do and not to do with them.
Yeah. That's a doozy of a thing to end with. Well, I will say I was on maternity leave this year and I left in April. And when I left, it was like AI panic. And everyone was freaking out, and I'm back, and it's more like AI acceptance, right? And people are figuring out ways to incorporate AI into shows in a smart way. And this is a story I'm working on right now, actually, is looking at some of those ways that aren't corrosive for the industry overall, right? Like, I don't think any of us want podcasts that are completely AI generated. You know, what's the point? But it does open up some different ways of producing podcasts that can be interesting, like creating voiceovers for social media posts, which is the way that so many people communicate now, for which there's no audio. Anyway, the point is that you'll start seeing it incorporated in lots of ways and in ways that you don't even know about. I mean, hopefully they do a disclosure, but they may not always. So it definitely has the power to transform what we listen to.
Ariel, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That's Ariel Shapiro, lead reporter for The Verge's audio industry newsletter, Hot Pod, and a graduate of UW-Madison. She joined us today for a look at the ups and downs of the podcast industry, where it might be headed next. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your favorite podcast now, or maybe one that has come and gone. Let us know about it. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.